Jay Beam.
So thank you very much, Vidanya, and good morning, brothers. I'm going to start off by trying to establish some principles for looking at the Dhamma revolution in the West, and then I'll, if I've got time, I'll take some of the questions that you asked that I haven't implicitly answered in my talk. So yes, we saw yesterday that the Dhamma can be revolutionary. The Dhamma is revolutionary. Dr. Ambedkar brought about at least the beginnings of a Dhamma revolution in India on the basis of the Dhamma. How can it be a Dhamma revolution in any other way? He saw that through the Dhamma, one can begin to bring liberty, equality, and fraternity. Liberty meaning a situation, a society within which nobody is constrained against their will. People are free to live the kind of life that they consider best, and as long as they do not harm or infringe the liberty of others. Equality meaning that everybody has broadly the same opportunities, at least to begin with. It was quite clear that not everybody is equal in talent or in nature or character, but that everybody should start with broadly the same opportunities in life. And fraternity, which is perhaps the area where he has the most interesting things to say, fraternity means an attitude of respect and reverence for others. He equates democracy with fraternity, a state of mind, as we saw yesterday. Democracy is a state of mind, the attitude of reverence and respect for other citizens, which is ultimately an attitude of metta, of maitri, and which is the basis, or rather has its basis in Sila. He equates maitri with ethics, with Sila. Ethics is the working out of metta. So society should be underlain by the principles of ethics, which have their roots in attitudes of respect, reverence, even maitri, love. So, yes, Dr. Ambedkar saw the Dhamma as the basis for a truly equal, just, free society, one in which there was a real sense of community, a real sense of love between citizens. So what we need to do is, in the West, is follow his prescription. We need to bring the Dhamma to bear on social, political, and economic questions. We need to allow the power of the Dhamma to transform us and to transform society. That's really all there is to it. That's the answer to all the questions. We need to allow the power of the Dhamma to transform us and to transform society. But what do we mean? What is the Dhamma? When I talk about allowing the power of the Dhamma to transform us and society, what do I mean very specifically by the Dhamma? Well, of course, you can answer that question in so many different ways, but I want to focus very briefly on the essence of the matter. The Dhamma is the way things are. It's the way reality really is, truly is. And, well, we know that's expressed in terms of the three lakshanas. Everything is impermanent. Everything is without permanent identity. Everything is unsatisfactory from an absolute point of view. There's nothing in life that can give you enduring pleasure, satisfaction, fulfillment. Again, we know it in terms of the more fundamental principle of pratitya samuppada, conditioned arising. Everything is conditioned. There's no phenomenon that you can be aware of, internal condition that you can be aware of, that is not subject to change, that does not arise from previous conditions and provide the conditions for future events. So everything is conditioned. Reality is a process of conditioned arising. But from the point of view of what is the Dhamma in terms of personal transformation and in terms of the transformation of society, there are two aspects of the overall principle of conditionality that we need to remember and focus on. we need to focus on the principle of karma, which is the working out of conditionality within the sphere of individualized consciousness. Karma states the way in which a self-conscious individual acts and interacts with the world around. You know the principles very well. Skillful action, actions performed with a helpful state of mind, lead to inner fulfillment and a smoother path through life. Actions performed with hatred and greed and out of blindness leads to increasing suffering, internal sense of frustration and stultification, and also a rough ride in life. So the principle of karma is the Dhamma within the sphere of moral action. But we need to look more deeply. The Dhamma goes deeper than karma. There is a principle of conditionality which leads us deeper and deeper beyond ourselves, if you like. There's a higher kind of conditionality which unfolds when the Dhamma emerges within our experience fully. It just unfolds, as it were, independently of us, beyond us. So there's a kind of conditionality that leads us to enlightenment. And these two, the karma principle and the Dhamma principle, are buried deep in reality. They're not added on to it. They're not something we think into life. There's something we discover in life. As I said yesterday, just as we discover the law of gravity by observing the fall of objects, we can discover the principle of karma, even, you might say, the law of karma. We can see in our own experience that skillful action leads to a greater sense of fulfillment, a greater openness and sensitivity of consciousness. We can see that the Dhamma, as we allow it to unfold within us, moves us, as it were, almost, you might say, independently of us. We can see that most exemplified in the lives of the great beings, most importantly of the Buddha himself. We can see that he entered a stream that led to enlightenment, to full enlightenment. So these principles are buried in life. They're not something that Buddhism, as it were, thinks up, rather. There's something that the Buddha discovered in life, lying there, so to speak, as potentials always ready to be discerned, just as the law of gravity, the law of photosynthesis, and so forth, are there waiting within the potentialities of life. So when I say that the bringing the Dhamma to bear on the social and political and economic situation, so that it's transformed in a positive direction, a direction that brings greater and greater happiness and freedom and community to more and more people, what I mean is bringing these principles to bear. Bringing the principle of karma and the principle of Dhamma to bear within society. And I think we need to think in terms of three particular targets or areas in which it needs to be brought to bear. First of all, we need to bring the Dhamma to bear on those who are marginalised and disadvantaged within society. This is where Dr. Ambedkar really began. He began with his own people, the Dalits of India. He brought the Dhamma to bear on them. And what the Dhamma did for them was really, you could say, mainly at the level of karma. It showed them that they were human beings, like everybody else. They were not to be defined by some cosmic myth. They were to be defined by their personal responsibility, by their capacity for ethical conduct. That's what defined them. That's what makes you a human being. You heard last night the reading from the Vasala Sutta, I think, in which the Buddha says that what makes you an outcast, an untouchable, is not your birth, it's your worth. You're an untouchable if you don't acknowledge any ethical principles. You're an untouchable if you don't act in accordance with moral standards. You're a Brahmin, not by birth, you're a Brahmin according to whether you act skillfully or not, whether your actions are helpful to self, helpful to others. That's what defines you. So what we can do for those who are poor, marginalized, excluded, prejudice is brought against them, we can teach them the Dhamma that shows them that they are responsible human beings, that their worth is found in their acceptance of their responsibility for their own actions. We can give them, through the Dhamma, a sense of their common humanity. And we can show them through the Dhamma, they can discover within the Dhamma the power to help themselves, not to passively wait for others to help them, but to lift themselves up and to find for themselves a better life through skillful action, through responsible action. This is what the Dhamma gives to those who are poor and marginalized. It gives it in a very practical way. It says, your slum is your responsibility. Yes, you can go to government. You can get from government what the government should be giving you. Claim your rights under the law, under the constitution, whatever it may be. But help yourself. Don't wait for others. Clear things up for yourself. Tidy things up for yourself. Come together. In Dr. Ambedkar's words, educate yourself. Struggle. That is, struggle for a better life. Organize yourselves so that you can really get what you need, what you deserve as a human being. So the first message of the Dhamma is, you could say, for those who have been left out by society, sometimes, as it were, by accident, sometimes very deliberately and consciously and even ideologically. The Dhamma can help them to lift themselves up through this, taking responsibility, through a sense of human worth. And I think there are many, many people all over the world, perhaps even many people in this country, who could benefit from that message. I've had personal experience of this through work that some of our Dhamma Mitras are doing in Hungary, among gypsies. It's small beginnings have been made, but it's very, very impressive the way in which the Dhamma gives a sort of backing to the attempt by our gypsy brothers and sisters there to make something of their lives, especially to get education and to take responsibility for their own environment. So, for instance, we have in a small village in northern Hungary, in a little village called Soyokaza, where half the village are gypsies, there's a woman's sangha. And these women have came together. They came to see our Dhamma Mitras, and they wanted to hear about the work in India. I showed them slides of what women are doing in the slums in India and so forth. So they said, well, we'll do that here. And they formed a women's sangha. They're particularly concerned about, well, quite a number of issues, drunkenness in the gypsy community, because it's the usual resort of those who are excluded is alcohol, because it dims things for a bit. Same in India. Increasingly glue sniffing and abuse of prescription drugs by young people, that sort of thing. They're concerned about the facilities that they get, because in that village you've got quite a nice, it's not the richest end of Europe by any means, but the streets are paved, there are street lights and so forth, there are reasonably good facilities. And you get to the edge of the village, all that stops, and these rows of broken down old miners' cottages, roofs broken, standpipes, no internal plumbing, no proper sewage facilities, no street lights. Just, 2 yards. You move 2 yards and you're into the third world. It really is the third world in Europe. And so they're beginning to say, go to the town meeting, go to the town hall when there's a council meeting. Everybody's entitled to attend. So there's rows of gypsy women sitting there with their arms crossed, watching the councillors as they deliberate. And, the councillors are taking a little bit more care of the gypsy end of the settlement. So as a result of their contact with the Buddha Dhamma, they don't know much about Buddhism, but as a result of their contact with our Dhamma Mitras and the message they're getting from Dr. Ambedkar and from Buddhism, they're beginning to take responsibility for their own lives. They're not just waiting for handouts. They're trying to make something of their own lives. It's very, very impressive. I've got some pictures of them. I'll put it up on the board. If you want to know more about that work, go to jaibhim.hu, jaibhim.hu, and you'll see the work that our mitras there are doing in North Hungary, under the inspiration of Dr. Ambedkar, through the Buddha Dhamma. So this is the sort of thing that the Dhamma does. To begin with, you don't make a big deal about Buddhism. They're quite happy to recite the refuges and precepts. They don't really know fully what they mean, but they sort of feel some sympathy with Buddhism, because Buddhism is teaching them how to take responsibility for themselves. And our friends have now started a political party in Hungary, because gypsies have no representation in parliament. Well, I think there was one member, but not anymore. All the parties in Hungary have moved drastically to the right. 40% of people in that village that I've been talking about voted for an extreme right-wing fascist party that is anti-gypsy, explicitly anti-gypsy. So the white people all voted for an anti-gypsy party. It looks, well, most of them did at least. So our friends have formed a party which has not yet got anywhere, of course, but this is early days. So that's an example of what the Buddha Dhamma can do for those who are poor and marginalised. And as I say, I think there are places even in Britain where that message is extremely valuable and important. Maybe not directly through the, becoming Buddhists, but at least hearing the Buddhist message, you're a human being, you are responsible for yourself, your own future is in your hands. If you act in a dignified, human way, you will get satisfaction, your life will be better. Just at that level even, it's very important. And there's so much opportunity for this all over the world, even in Britain. Think in your own environment. Where is the marginalisation? Where is the poverty, cultural poverty, if not economic poverty? For instance, I think there's a big issue of right-wing fascism in Britain. It's small time at the moment, although the BNP is fielding candidates for 50% of the constituencies in Britain at the next election. That's something to really take very seriously. So, who votes for them? Usually a poor white, working class, housing estate, if there are such things anymore, dwellers who really have very little in the way of culture, very little in the way of real sort of uplift, only the example of what they're not getting from their TVs. So, we need to think about how the Dhamma can be got to them. Now, you might think, how could you think of your centre? What's it got to do with those people? Precisely. That's the question. Precisely. What's it got to do with them? Well, you've got to make it have something to do with them. Well, you've got to go. You've got to try to see what is it that burns them. The Dhamma is the medicine for all ills. This is what the Buddha said, the Dhammosada, the medicine of the Dhamma. It satisfies all needs. So what are their needs? What is it that's burning them? Where does the Dhamma touch them? We need to think much more in these terms. Yes, it may be that they need quite straightforward material help. Well, give that. Help with that. But try to get beyond that to the deeper attitudinal needs, if you like. The mental set that they have and try to see where the Dhamma can help them to be bigger human beings, better human beings, more fulfilled human beings, and preferably not vote BNP. That's just a little measure, isn't it, of how far things go. But the Dhamma is the medicine for all ills. So we need to think much more scientifically, you might say, about where the Dhamma touches people. What is itching? What is where is the pain? What has the Dhamma got to say to that? It will have something. And it's for us to be much more intelligent, much more active, going out, looking at the situation and trying to bring the Dhamma to people. We can be very sort of narrow, I think, because most of us come from a middle-class educated background, or we've become middle-class educated if we weren't sort of by birth that. And our attitudes are by and large of that sort of liberal kind. It's difficult for us to place ourselves in the position of people who have a very different outlook on life. Some of us have that still, we preserve that, but we need to get outside the preserve that we presently move within. Buddhism is not just for the middle classes. It can't be. That's what Dr. Ambedkar proved. Buddhism is for the uneducated, the illiterate, those who are not even a working class, an unemployed class. It's for everybody. And if it's not getting through, that's because we are not thinking boldly enough. I was going to say aggressively enough, but you understand what I mean. In a sense, aggressively. I think we need to think even, if you like, let not be afraid of thinking of selling the Dhamma. You know, if somebody wants to sell soap, they need to try and find why somebody should buy it. And then you need to tell them that this product will do what they want it to do. I mean, because it does, so that's preferably the case. Not just rhetoric is not enough. So you need to find that the fit of the Dhamma to the need that people have. I think that we need to be, in any situation, looking around at our own town, our own area, and just seeing there are huge areas, often, where nobody comes to the centre. Nobody comes to the centre from there. So how do you get to them? What is it that's eating them? And what is the food that you've got that they will want to taste? And don't think that, that those people in the from a less educated background are not accessible to religion. Actually, they're the cannon fodder of religion. That religion often feeds upon such people in sometimes quite unpleasant ways. And there's still a lot of I think potential for getting Dhamma across, but it's not going to be the sort of rather tame, reasonable, calm religion, perhaps, that we all know and love. Well, maybe not. It's going to have to be something much more emphatic, much more convinced, and much more a sort of glorious. I think it's fascinating that I've read somewhere, I need to verify it, that the biggest religious movement in Britain is the Spiritualist Church, and it's big in working class areas. Probably some of you know it from your own background. It's very common in London, East End of London. I know people who've come from that background whose parents, like Sona's mother was a medium and a healer, and you'll find that very commonly. So. They're actually, Buddhism has got things to say that we don't usually say. We're rather apologetic about rebirth. Well, you don't have to believe it, But actually, there are people who want to hear about that, and want to know about that, and are sort of rather, trimmed down, sceptical, rationalised, middle class, tame version. you know, doesn't even get most of us middle class tame people. So we need to give something that's much more lively, much more all-embracing, much more emphatic, and really looking to see what people's needs are, where the Dhamma can touch them. Secondly, the more general society. Of course, such people are part of general society, and I rather sort of blurred the lines of what I was saying, but... if you like, the society as a whole in the modern West is dominated by an outlook that is thoroughly materialist. I mean materialist in the philosophical sense, but really does not accept that there's anything beyond matter apart from a momentary glow on the surface of matter, which is consciousness. Which dies out once the conditions have passed. The predominant sort of social force is consumerism, possessive individualism. That's the sort of broad view that is around in Western society. Of a nice kind, it's what Nietzsche referred to in... I started to say which one it is, but I can't remember. But anyway, he talked about it in a number of places, that the way in which Western society is sort of drifting towards what he called a positive nihilism, where there's no non-worldly perspective. God is definitely dead. But we're all nice to each other until the lights go out. So we're just sort of getting a little bit of pleasure, trying to be as nice to each other as we can, and accepting that in the end, it's all in the end. The curtains come down. There's a fading of values. There's a suspicion of values, partly because of the horrible history of the 20th century. There's a suspicion of leaders, a suspicion of ideals. And again, because of the horrible history that we've come from, because of our revolt against the oppressive hierarchy of the church, the oppressive hierarchy of the aristocracy and monarchies and so forth, colonialism. We're in revolt against all that, quite rightly. But yes, that's meant there's a suspicion of anything that's of any elevation. So we're up against that. And if we want to transform society, that's primarily what we need to tackle. So how do we do it? We do it by communicating the Dhamma, communicating the perspective that the Dhamma has on life. The way people act emerges out of their view of life. People's ethics stands upon their philosophy, if you like. Even though they may not have an articulate philosophy, they've got an implicit one. So most people's implicit philosophy is materialist, even if they're Christian. They're actually materialist. They don't really have sufficient conviction in, an afterlife or God's message or Christ's salvific role. They're really convinced by that. Church is usually, for the few who go to it, there's growing numbers now, but the few from the old white classes that go to it, it doesn't have much beyond a social meaning. So really people's philosophical basis is in a mild nihilistic materialism, which fuels a consumer mentality and an idea that the pursuit of self-fulfillment within the boundaries of materialistic nihilism is all life is about. You fulfill yourself through a kind of consumer satisfaction and a consumption of entertainment. That's pretty much what life holds for you. So we need to communicate the values, the fundamental perspective of the Dhamma. The fundamental perspective of the Dhamma about the way things are. As I indicated at the beginning, we need to communicate the principle of karma, the principle that inner fulfillment comes from the way you act, the way you think, the way you speak, the way you act, that is what brings satisfaction or fulfillment. That opens your mind up. That sensitizes you so you're capable of deeper, higher experience and pleasure. We need to communicate that the Dhamma is a potentiality within experience which can unfold when you align yourself with it, and that will lead you to the highest possible fulfillment. So we need to communicate the way things are, conditioned co-production, with these two fundamental spiral principles within it, the principle of karma, the principle of Dhamma. We need to communicate a scale of values, assert a scale of values, that there are values. I remember once giving a talk in which I talked about the Buddha as the sort of pinnacle of human development. And afterwards somebody contended with me that that was not the proper way to talk, because the Buddha was not more developed than anybody else. He was merely differently developed from everybody else. But don't argue. Just is the point at which all you can say is no, more developed. There's a point at which, where values are concerned, argument runs out. You cannot prove it. You need to assert it. So yes, we need to communicate the way things are, and the scale of values that follows from that, and the ethical principles that follow from that scale of values. And yes, assertion is in the end the most important thing. This might seem strange, because in a way, you know, we value reason so highly, and of course one should be as reasonable as possible. But I think you'll be surprised at the power of assertion. Confidence is almost the most important thing. Most people are looking for something to have confidence in. They need to hear values expressed confidently. Values that do not contradict reason. A fundamental description of the way things are that does not contradict reason and science. But they need to hear it expressed with confidence, with even a degree of force. So what we fundamentally need to do is let the Buddhist voice be heard. We need to proclaim it loudly. We need to proclaim it clearly. We need to let our politicians hear the voice of the Dhamma. We've got this wonderful opportunity at the moment. They want our votes. They have to listen to us. They may forget it instantly afterwards, but my belief is that once something is asserted, it rings in the mind. Once something is asserted, it remains living in society, in the sort of collective consciousness. We need to have belief in the power of the Dhamma, that we're speaking, the Dhamma is speaking and speaking through us, the voice of truth. And the truth has a power. So when you assert the truth, even if people don't listen very carefully, something remains, something rings. So get your politicians, you've got a few weeks left, a few days left, get them, force them to listen to you. You know, hold your vote up and say, here's my vote, beg. Hind legs, beg. They will. That's what politicians are about. Get them to your centre, but put them up against the wall. Ask them the searching questions. I've gone into this a little bit in some talks I gave at the LBC, were Rambles Around Reality, latest version. You can get them from Free Buddhist Audio. Yeah, you get them to listen. All our candidates in the LBC are Muslims. Well, they need to explain to us where they stand as Muslims in relation to democracy. We need to know. Unfortunately, Islam allows them to lie to us, but taqliya. But is that right? Have I got that right? Yeah. But you know, at least they should be on record as having answered. So you know, get your politicians, see the moral principles that you want them to answer to, and get them to speak. Yeah, they'll do what they like later, but at least they've spoken, at least they've been influenced to some extent. And there are good people who stand in politics, there's no doubt. So they will respond. And vote for the politician who seems to most appreciate and value the Dhamma principles that you've adumbrated, and the policies that seem least out of tune with the Dhamma. So speak to politicians when the opportunity is there, when you've got that vote dangling above them, that carrot that they need to beg for, their bone they need to beg for. But not only then, we need to speak into politics all the time. I think probably the entering into active party politics is too dodgy for most people. But local politics, where there is a potential for non-party politics, I think it would be good if some of us were involved there. And I know some people have been standing for local community councils. I think somebody stood here in Sirlingham. I don't think he got in, but I think... Oh, Promudita. Did you get in?
Nearly.
I'm afraid nearly is not good enough. Try harder. So, yes, we need to even become a bit involved. I think that the problem with the party system is that you have to subordinate your own principles to the party's manifesto and so forth. It's very difficult in English politics, at least British politics, to have an independent line, although it's perhaps not impossible. We need to use the media. We need to let the Buddhist voice be heard. And those of us who have the skill with the pen or the skill with the media in other ways, on the radio or whatever, we need to use that. I think Vishvapani did some wonderful programs for Thought for the Day on Radio 4. If anybody wants to listen to what a Buddhist can do, listen to those. I think they're exemplary. They're very, very skillful and sophisticated application of Buddhist principles in a way that really did stand out, although there are some very good speakers from other religions too. They're very, very witty and intelligent speakers from other religions. But let the Buddhists who have that skill use the opportunities and speak out. Not just always speaking to ourselves or people like us. I think we too easily think of going to the margins, the alternative. Well, yeah, we've got to apply to the margins. But the mainstream, we need to get the voice, the Buddhist voice, heard in the mainstream. Address the issues that Buddhism has got something distinctive to say about. And use the media, use the political processes. At the moment, the present government is quite keen to hear what faith groups have to say. Well, we should use that opportunity. You don't want to get lost in it all, and this is a danger I'll be returning to later, but we need to let the Buddhist voice be heard. It's a cogent voice. It's an intelligent voice. It's a voice that is not actually going to be resisted that much. Buddhism has a very good reputation, and it's simply based on an observation of the way things are. It's an observation of the way things arise. Conditions give rise to consequences. So with the eye of the Buddha Dhamma, we can observe and we can speak the truth in a simple, direct, clear, cogent way. We should do that far, far more than we've been doing, so that the Buddhist perspective is heard. I've been very interested by the debate recently in Britain on what is it to be British, because of such a large, it's not even a question of non-white, it's not even, but people whose ancestors are not from these islands, as it were, even white people in that position. So what is their relationship to Britain? What is it to be a British citizen today? It's clearly not, John Major's delightful vision of warm beer and long shadows and the sound of a willow on leather. It's a lovely image, isn't it? Actually, it makes me quiver with horror. Reminds me of my school. But it doesn't work anymore. It's just not the life that anybody lives. It's not England today. So what is England? What is Britain? especially where, you know, there are other, the Welsh and the Scots and the Irish have their own strong sense of national identity. What is it to be English? So surely Buddhism has got something to say about this. It's something to do with values. Not, you know, values like cricket, but it's ridiculous, isn't it, to identify England with cricket when we lose all the time. Ah, no, of course, we identify with losing as well. That's what it is to be English. Sorry, cut it out. I was born in England, but I'm not really English. What is it? What are the values that make one British or German or whatever it is? You know, Germany is a large Turkish population. Well, what is it for them to be German, if they're allowed to be, and so on? So we need to identify the principles that underlie citizenship. And we've got something very, very intelligent to say about that. Another talk, another day. So the Dhamma is the truth about the way things are. It's the truth that morality is natural, that the principle of karma is natural. It's interesting, there's been this research, hasn't there, led by British economists and thinkers, particularly into the science of hedonics. What is it that brings happiness? You know, Richard Layard's book, he was a little bit involved in the opening of the Breathworks, wasn't he? I think he actually formally opened it. But he's written a very good book, very interesting book, bringing together the latest sort of research on what makes people happy, called Happiness. A very good book indeed. And by and large, what you read in that is it's karma that makes people happy. It's not spelt out in those terms, but it's a good life. Material development works up till you've got about $10,000 a year. After that, you get less, you know, less and less increases in happiness. And at a certain point, it begins to reverse. Americans have become less happy over the last decades than they were before. So at a certain point, material well-being doesn't increase happiness. There has to be something more. Interestingly enough, I read recently Dr. Ambedkar making precisely this point, that it's certainly true that poverty brings unhappiness, but it's not true that prosperity brings happiness. Happiness is brought by the evolution of the mind, the culture of the mind. And this is what the scientific inquiry shows. So we're just talking about what is. Karma is a description of the way life works. So we just need to make that clear. Happiness is governed by inner laws, to some extent by external ones, but only to a limited extent. After a certain point of material development, inner values are what bring satisfaction. The highest potential of the human mind unfolds naturally in accordance with determined laws and conditions. This is what we're setting before people, not something that it requires them to believe things they can't investigate, that you know, something happened, 2,000 years ago, that God somehow or other made himself man and all that nonsense. You're not required to believe all that. We're simply required to believe that reality works in a particular way that you can see. You can see it in yourself, you can see it in others. This is what we're trying to get across. These are truths that are available to all. And we need to have the confidence in them ourselves, to live by them ourselves, and the confidence to assert those principles within society and to apply them to the social issues that we find around us, the political, economic, social issues that we find around us. We need to address the issue of the economy by looking at where happiness comes from. You know, all the measures are of growth, aren't they? That's the only value. You know, Britain's all just about getting to be all right because the economy grew by 0.2% in this quarter. It's not enough, of course, but it needs to grow more because the whole thing works on growth. You know, you can't have credit without growth because the banks need in order to lend money, they need the economy to be growing so that there's more profit, more interest coming to them that they can then keep the whole thing going by. It's just crazy. It just can't continue to work, or it can only continue to work at certain costs, which occasionally will become apparent. And we need to be sort of looking at this quite plainly, just saying, well, look, this is not the way to measure the success of a society, of a nation. We shouldn't be measuring it simply on whether it's growing or not. We should be looking to other values. So of course, there are economists like Layard who are doing this, but we should be really asking our politicians, well, how do you evaluate the success of Britain? It's a good question, isn't it, when you've got them up against the wall. Well, what for you is success? What will you be judging the success of your policies against? Is it on the increase in fulfilment, a sense that people are becoming of greater moral worth and value, of greater cultural value? Is it that, or is it simply that they've got more consumer goods? So, yes, we need to have the confidence in these truths, the way that life works. We need the confidence to really live by them ourselves, and the confidence then to assert them in public. It's not enough just to exemplify. I was asked this question. It's not enough just to exemplify. It's important to exemplify, but it's not enough. You need to be asserting. People need to hear the truth of the Dhamma. I think it's a pious hope that if you're a good person and happy, people will be like you. Well, some may. But they need to hear why, what it is that you're living by. They need to hear values that they can live by. They need to hear them confidently expressed, clearly expressed. Of course, they need to be intelligently expressed, reasonably expressed, cogently expressed. If you've got that sort of mind in a way that demolishes arguments, if you've got that sort of ability. If you haven't, then stay clear of that field. But assert those values intelligently. Good values expressed in an unintelligent way simply denies those values. Express them at the same time with appeal, with imagination, with a certain rhetorical colour, if you see what I mean, which comes from your real feeling for these values. So express them with your own conviction, with your own confidence in them. This is what we need to be doing within society as a whole. Making these values known, making them felt, making these principles on which those values stand widely understood and heard, so that whenever there's a debate, the Buddhist view is heard. It's not to do with God, it's to do with the way conditions work, and so on. So that's the second target area of our making the Dhamma felt within society. Perhaps it's the most important and widest. Of course, there's a third area, which I'm not going to go into because it's pretty obvious, and it's the one where we are at least doing our best, even if we could do a lot better, and that's appealing to those who really do feel within them the desire for some kind of higher human life. And there are many, many such. I think if you look around, you can sort of broadly see that there's a percentage of people, who knows what percentage. I remember Bhante saying he thought it was roughly 1 in 10. He said that if you go into a situation, you look around, you sort of get the impression, there's sort of that person over there, that person over there. There's some look in their eye. There's something about them that suggests they're not satisfied with the ordinary consumer life or ordinary family life, ordinary social life. They want something more. They know life means more than this. There has to be more. They know that. Everybody perhaps feels it sometime. I remember again Nietzsche saying in Schopenhauer's Educator, what young man does not awake in the middle of the night with the feeling that there has to be more to life. So everybody perhaps feels that sort of uneasy breath on their face at some times. But there are those who cannot forget it, who cannot leave it, We need to be appealing to them in a very powerful and direct way. There is a higher life. There are higher values. The ordinary life that most people live, it's okay, but it's not enough. It's not enough to really satisfy and fulfill a human aspiration. So there's more. Give yourself to that more. And we need then to give them the opportunity to do so through our centres and then further through a deeper experience and opportunity within life. So these are the three principal sort of targets I think we need to be keeping in mind. Firstly, those who are marginalised and deprived, and especially culturally deprived or economically deprived, socially excluded. We need to be showing them what they can do which will help them to overcome their situation. The Dalits in India, they haven't been accepted on their own terms, as it were, by others, but they've forced others to take them seriously. The Buddhists in Maharashtra are taken very seriously. In fact, there's a strong movement amongst Maharashtrian Brahmins, and you don't get much more Brahminical than a Maharashtrian Brahmin. There's a strong movement to marry their daughters to Buddhist sons, because the Buddhists are successful. Several of our order members, their sons have married Brahmin wives. Interesting, eh? And, it's not necessarily a good thing, but it's at least a good sign. The Dhamma, when it's really taken on by those who are poor and marginalised, means they have to be taken seriously by others, because there's something substantial. They're not just going to let themselves be pushed around. We need to be trying to get into the mainstream of society as much of the Buddhist voice as we can, and much of the Buddhist perspective on what life really is, as much of a perspective on the way life works, as much of a perspective on what values really are, where they're to be found. Some foundation for values that is not external, and that is not merely relative. That's what Buddhism offers. It offers values that stand, as it were, in nature itself, but that are not merely chosen by the individual human being. Between God and relativism, that's where Buddhism stands. And then, yes, we need to be trying to make the Buddhist message heard by those who are desperately wanting sometimes some higher life. So to do this work creating a new society in these three ways, we need to be strong. We need to have the opportunity ourselves to really live out the Buddhist life. We need what Bhante called the nucleus of a new society. We need situations in which our aspirations are supported. It's so dispiriting, isn't it, when you are fired up by the Dhamma, and you talk to people and it just falls flat, or they just argue. You need to have the sense that you're working along the same lines as some other people, at least until you're so strong that nothing can stop you. You need to involve yourself in a community, a living community where your aspiration is matched by others, not in a superficial, oh yes, I agree with you, but a matched by way of life, that people are living out the values that you have, preferably even living them out more than you do. You need that. Otherwise, very, very difficult to maintain. So often you see people losing it because they just don't get the support they need. I've encountered that so much in my work in the order and movement. You see people come along, they're very, very strong aspiration, life's currents carry them away. You meet them later, they say, I just could not sustain it. I never lost my belief in it, but I couldn't sustain it. The circumstances I found myself in were too much for me. Don't forget this. We need that sort of support, that sort of community. If we can, we need the places to live. We need to live with people who share our aspiration. It's terrible living with people who deny your aspiration or just indifferent to it. Indifference is probably a more powerful sedative than opposition. Opposition sharpens your wits. Indifference sends you to sleep. You just calm down and just join in. So we need to work with and live with and preferably work with people who share the same aspiration, who are living out the same values, who are struggling in the same values. We need to learn with others the sort of materials for that spiritual life. So we need to go where the Dhamma is plentiful until we have got it so much in us that we are the Dhamma and we cannot lose it. That's our first job, is really to create that nucleus so that we can speak loudly and clearly within society. If you don't have it, it's very, very difficult. Well, Dr. Ambedkar at one point, I think one of the conversations he had with Bhante, it's a bit hazy in my mind, but he said something to Bhante along the lines of, I'm the most unpopular man in India. Nobody will listen to me. He had to fight alone. He had to stand alone. Nobody was with him. Even his own lieutenants were against his conversion. So you have to be a real lion to stand alone like that. Bhante, in his early days in England, had to stand alone. It's very, very difficult. And some of you who may have, you may have had some experience of this. So you need that sort of strong support. I remember Bhante saying about one Tibetan Tulku, incarnate Lama, who'd gone to America and, gathered a group around him and so forth and created a sort of a philosophy and a structure and so forth. He said the impression he had was that he was a bodhisattva who'd taken rebirth and then forgotten he was a bodhisattva. You know, because America is so seductive that you forget why you're there. So I know I came here for some reason. I'm afraid old age, I'm beginning to feel like that quite often. So there's a danger that, all your high ideals, you just cannot sustain. I know so many order members who've gone somewhere fresh with great, great aspiration, and you just can't keep it up. There's so much against you. You need to have the strength to do that, and you need to gather that strength from accumulation, from gathering together with others who share your aspiration. That's what Bhante meant by the nucleus of a new society. It's somewhere where those who have this aspiration, who want to change society, can gather the support to do so. It's on that basis you might begin to think of entering politics. But without it, politics will just take you over. It's happened to so many people outside the Buddhist sphere. You just get lost in the party fighting and so on. You need the basis of the spiritual community to really begin to work within society. We also need this new the nucleus of a new society as an example of what can be. I'm sure that everybody who's come here gets something from being at Padmaloka, from the way in which Padmaloka is. There's something in the air of Padmaloka. There's something in the way that people from Padmaloka relate, the welcome that they give you, the very, very positive environment, the way everything's put together. It all shows you, something you think, well, this is what should be. This is the way life should be. This is the way society should be. You get something from being together in this men's event. You get some sense of, well, this is what I'd like all the time. I remember that from my very first retreat. I remember coming back sort of thinking, I wish I could have this all the time. I want this all the time. Maybe with a bit of telly occasionally. But, you want something much more, at least telly with friends, so spiritual friends. Actually, I'm never particularly interested in telly. So, yes, you want something that really gives an example of what society can be. And that's a source of guidance and support for those who are not able to be more deeply involved with this. I was recently at the LBC and I met with a group of volunteers, diakas, who keep the LBC clean, look after the reception, do some of the basic administration. They do a lot of work, actually. Very, very impressive. And they're all saying how much they appreciated working there. I was thanking them. They're saying, no, no, no. You know, it's we who are grateful for this opportunity because it gives us a way of being part of the community. We can participate. Because there are people who are working full-time, because there are people living in the communities, we can participate. We can get something from it. If that wasn't there, it wouldn't be so meaningful to them. So, yes, we need to give to create the basis of for our own lives so that we can influence society. We need to create an example of what society could be, and we need to offer opportunity for those who cannot participate in that full-time way to occasionally be uplifted by it, such as at a retreat like this. But it's a basis. It's a basis for going out into society. Bante said, sometimes people talk about finding the FWBO a sort of oasis in a desert. Sorry, Tri Ratna community, a sort of oasis in a desert. And, you know, with a great, great sort of relief, they find water and cool shade and so forth. But he said, you have to be careful. Your aspiration is to make that desert become, make that oasis spread throughout the whole desert. But what tends to happen with some of us is we find the oasis, we settle down under the cool shade of the trees, we drink the water, you know, a loaf of bread, a bottle, and thou, and that's it. To Baudelaire's Khayyam. Yes, we need to be thinking of expanding that oasis so that it fills the desert. We do need the oasis. Most of us would die of thirst without the oasis. We would just burn up in the heat of the sun. We'd just become dispirited and lost because of the directionlessness of the unending sand. So we need the oasis, but we must aspire to make that oasis grow to transform the whole desert. But to do that, to do any of this, to create the nucleus and then to try to transform the whole of society, we need confidence in the Dhamma. We need confidence ourselves in the power of the Dhamma to transform society, transform ourselves. And we need to proclaim it far more vigorously and confidently and intelligently, sensitively, going out, looking at where there are opportunities, creating openings, having the courage to go again and again to that dismal, hall somewhere in the wastelands of the suburbs with one person who's clearly there because they've got nothing better to do. You just keep going. And eventually something will happen. You're as intelligent as you can, as skillful as you can. You will find an opening. That's guaranteed. It's the nature of reality. That's what you're bringing to people. So some will see it. So you need to have that that confidence so that you can proclaim the Dhamma far more vigorously and intelligently. And yes, we need to create the basis for that proclamation in the nucleus of a new society by creating and strengthening and spreading those basic institutions, Padmaloka being an outstanding example. And, there are many others. We have, for instance, a wonderful working situation at Windhorse Trading. It's a little embattled at the moment, but it's still very much alive as a part of the new society. People from South America can come and take full advantage of it. You can't get that in Venezuela, in Mexico. So, we need to use and develop and grow this nucleus. Otherwise, we can't sustain our effort. We won't be able to personally sustain the effort. We won't have the basis to go out. So, I think I probably implicitly dealt with most of the questions that are there, and I've run out of time, so I'm not going to pick up the sheaf of questions that are here. But I hope I've given you at least a way of answering the sort of questions that you asked me. And I hope more than anything I've persuaded you that the Dhamma is the medicine for the ills of the world. And I hope I've persuaded you that what is needed is your confidence in it, your practice of it, and your proclamation of it in the most powerful and persuasive way that you can. If we do that, I'm convinced that the Dhamma could be a major force within Western society, and that means throughout the world. It certainly can in India if we can work much more vigorously there. There's plenty of opportunity. And I think there are many places all over the world where the message of the Dhamma is not so alien. Yeah, we can think of a large slice of the world where it's pretty alien, but there's a huge slice where it's not so alien. The places like China, which are anciently Buddhist, and where an intelligent new presentation of the Dhamma in the terms that Sangharakshita has laid out for us, I think will be welcome. I found that myself in Singapore. Many Chinese Buddhists are saying, this is such a relief to hear the Dhamma put in modern terms, in intelligent terms. So, have confidence in the Dhamma, the power of the Dhamma itself. This is Dr. Ambedkar's message. It's the way people understand life. It's the basis for their values that needs to change. Once they hear that the Dhamma, once they see the Dhamma as the basis for real human values, then society will begin to change. There's no political and social or even economic revolution without a preceding cultural revolution, without a preceding change in values. And that is our job.